missed your call, but if you'd leave your name and number, I would love to call you back just as soon as I can. Thank you again for calling, and I'll talk to you soon.
Greetings, this is the automatically deleted husband, and what a joy! I got some mail today! I got a postcard! Two of them! It was great! Postcards that I sent. They were returned. You know, it's both of them to George. George, remember the guy who wrote me 3 years ago now? Said, you know, that line, I wish we were family again. Does he know? Does he have any idea that these were sent to him? It is important to note one of them. George, I'm inviting you again to hike with me as an act of love. Returning this card before you see it is illegal, and what kind of act? Obviously, the implication wasn't an act of love. It's an act of hate. It's an act of hate. You know, and because if you go online, you know, go to kozlowska.org/promise, you can see, because there's the button there for refused. And the stack of cards that are refused now is quite large. And you can see them, obviously, on the wall there. So if anybody wants to see them, they're there. Both the side, you know, it was nice and pristine when it left. And, of course, yeah, with the wear of going to North Carolina and back, and obviously the stamp and that famous refused sticker or rubber stamp that's on here. Wow! I just noticed this. It's this one, the one I just read about. Is refused, returned to sender at July 15th. And is there any information here? But, you know, I wondered why it took so long. The stamp here, Portland, Oregon. For those who don't know a map, that's on the other side of the country. Why? Why did it go to Portland, Oregon? The other one, Chattanooga. You know, my assumption is that you know, these cards, because I remember back in the, it was the 60s, late 60s, I went a couple times, actually, but went with my dad, who was doing, at the time, it was called special delivery. You know, before we had the various overnight services and whatnot, they had special delivery where you paid a premium in order to get something delivered quickly. And my dad, you know, he took a job for a couple of years, I think, where that's what he would do. He would drive his car and typically at night and deliver these priority mail. And I went with him once. You know, this is in Santa Barbara, and we were in downtown Santa Barbara at the post office at night. And, you know, I saw, because they had a, it was kind of like a big van, like an RV van, because inside it, they had all these, you know, like the post office, normal things, with all the little boxes to sort things. They had that in this van. They had people, you know, driving. And of course, there were some windows so you could see inside. And would drive from San Francisco to Los Angeles back and forth, like the round trip every day, which I thought was interesting because this was, you know, early versions of priority mail. And I remember seeing this array of all these big bags and the way somebody would take this and they would, you know, toss it into the various bags. And, you know, you could see then... The accuracy level was actually quite remarkable. But every once in a while, obviously, I'm going to put it into, you know, I'm going to take this envelope that goes to Linwood, North Carolina, and it's going to go to Texas or Oregon for you know, by accident. You know, I could see that happening. And I really wonder, that's probably what happened here, something like that. But, you know, it still amazes me because I wondered why this one took so long to come back. Because it went to Oregon. Anyway, And what a distraction. But, you know, this one, you know, I invited him to a hike because this was, you know, because, again, if you go to that page, there's the picture of me clinging to that tree at the top of Benton Falls. And again, I did the scared look because, you know, if you look behind me in the picture, you can see it was about 5 foot behind me. So, you know, I was comfortably away from the edge. But, you know, that edge was straight down for like 65 feet. And it's kind of like, oh. But anyway, it was a wonderful trip, Chris and I. You know, we took this, our typical, that was a typical 8 mile trip. And we turned it into 13, you know, our normal stuff. It's just great. But anyway, but, you know, the whole objective was to do that with George. Because, you know, some people may remember, George is my son. But the other one, the other card, this one only went to Chattanooga instead of Oregon. It says, George, you wrote me long ago stating, I wish we were family again. I still share that and wrote you many times. So, you know, those are his words. Has he ever known that I use it myself? And again, the thing that really I really wonder about, yes, and these will go on the wall here shortly. The thing I really wonder about is the likelihood of George, Susanna, Glory Jane, Walter, and Zadok, the young kid's young relative, that my assumption is still with my wife. What happens when they find out that probably what they've been told and reality are two different things? I really wonder what's going to happen to them. I mean, this is not a minor issue. This is a very major issue. But two other focuses, because again, I want some awareness of this. You know, I've talked about people who do uncomfortable, dangerous things. And one example is our reporters. I've mentioned Eva Bartlett, for example, who's currently lives apparently now in Russia, and, you know, and spends a lot of time in Ukraine. And she's on the kill list in Ukraine, which is, you know, really comfortable place to be, isn't it? And I have wonderful photos. That one right there, which on my wall, was taken by Eva Bartlett, Shadi Sheda, who lost his family to the moderate rebels in Syria. You know, in other words, the terrorists. Which brings up an interesting point, because I just watched a program I've mentioned previously. A gentleman, Aaron Mettey. He and the other gentleman, they have a program called The Gray Zone. And they are left of center. So, you know, you would say, okay, well, maybe I would disagree with them politically. Well, of course, I disagree with people who are right of center now, too. But because, again, of as I've matured as a follower of Christ. But that's another issue. But he was describing an article that was written by The Guardian, I think, major news organizations in the UK, and calling him one of the greatest promoters of propaganda or conspiracy theorists and things of that nature, especially around Syria. Which, again, goes back to, you know, that photo is a man in Syria. An article was printed that just simply accused him of all sorts of things. Gave no evidence. So what he did is he called the reporter. Because, you know, it was fascinating because I remember many years ago, when I was sitting in the theater in San Antonio, Texas, watching the brand new movie, All the President's Men. and, you know, which obviously with the Woodward and Bernstein events where they would, and they showed an example of where they would contact, I think it was Mitchell was his first name, Attorney General at the time. I think it was who they were contacted. They contacted him and said, you know, we're going to produce this. We're going to publish this story tomorrow. Do you want to comment on it first? And you know, because that's a credible journalist would do that. They would want to say, I'm not going to just simply slander somebody, but I want to have both sides of the question. So what this guy in the UK did to Aaron Maté was to simply slander him and offer no evidence. So Aaron Maté called him after the article was printed and asked him, why didn't you contact me? Will you answer some questions? You accused me of this, that, or the other. Do you have any evidence? Can you give me one example of misinformation? And the guy said, no, I'll send you an email. No. And apparently he was given an opportunity to respond later, you know, long after this thing was published, was limited on what he could write, and they even shrunk that. And then they included statements about how things like this need to be censored, and that needs to sink in. You need to censor those that are not part of the mainstream. Most of this was about the OPCW and the Duma alleged chemical attack, which, as I pointed out before, because I watched it, some committee at the UN had a hearing in order to see, because it's UN funded, I think, OPCW, about the results of their findings. And so they invited the whistleblowers who said, no, I mean, the report has been doctored. They invited them to New York to speak at the UN, and the US would not allow them to come into the United States. They said, no, you can't come. So they appeared via video link. And when questions or whatever particular point, the U.S. delegation simply walked out. It says, we're not going to hear the other side. I mean, you know, so I saw that. I watched that. You know, I normally don't watch UN meetings. I watched that one. And it's interesting. So, you know, because, again, the Duma raid, the evidence is overwhelming. And I've read the report. Well, I didn't read the report. I skimmed the report, but I have it. The one before it was doctored. Because, you know, the idea that the alleged canister that had the chemical weapons that was dropped, you can see the evidence. No, that didn't happen. All the deaths, the evidence is overwhelming. These people were placed, I think it's like a stairwell. They were placed there because they were already dead. I mean, the evidence is quite clear, and there's no evidence of chemical attacks, nothing. And so there's so many things like that. Oh, and one of the people who went to Duma to investigate this was none other than Eva Bartlett. But of course, you know, you cannot allow those people to have an audience because it's the wrong narrative. You know, I really wonder what's going to happen to people. It's just like the issue with George. What happens when they find out the truth? What happens when somebody finds out the truth about, oh, I thought we bombed Syria because it was the right thing to do. I thought we invaded Iraq because they had weapons of mass destruction. I thought we went into Afghanistan because they were part of 9/11. No, we went into Afghanistan because we needed a supply for the CIA, for drugs, for heroin. We went into Syria because we wanted to overthrow the government because, you know, because again, part of Syria is under control of Israel, the Golan Heights. But that belongs to Syria. It has for a long time. And basically the UN says it does. But Israel says, no, that's ours. And the U.S. agrees with Israel. The rest of the world agrees with Syria. So that's contested. But then again, Turkey has troops in Syria, which is obviously a problem. And about, was it about a quarter of the country or whatnot, especially where their oil is and where their wheat fields and so forth are, is currently under control by terrorists and being protected by the U.S. military. That's the northeast region. And because it has oil there, they're using that oil to fund the terrorists. I mean, this has been happening for 2 years. Again, it was Donald Trump who said, we need to get out of Syria, but take the oil. It's a thief. That's simply what a thief does. Because that is theft. But anyway, and again, we did the same thing in Iraq. We did the same thing in Libya and all those kind of places. Democrats and Republicans both do it. but, you know, and I think what's happening, because more and more Ukraine is falling apart. I think the latest thing is two high-level political figures were removed from their position. And it seems they're falling apart. And they're becoming more violent towards their own people. The attacks on the civilian population in the Donbass seems to be worse, and the overt threats to Crimea it has been made. You know, the saber rattling has been going strong, supported by the U.S. and Russia. Recently said. Yeah, you know, they call it a special military operation. That's, you know, their terms. This is not an act of war. And it was basically directly stated, you go into Crimea, this is war. So my assumption is if there's a minor or major attack into Crimea, the attack on the rest of Ukraine will be, you know, fast and furious. They will devastate it probably overnight. That would be my guess. You know, because again, the important thing to think of is what they did is that, because you may remember, they had that huge line of trucks on the road into Kiev or Kyiv, whichever your preference is. They had the huge lines of trucks, and they never really went into Kiev. But it pinned down the Ukrainian military to protect it. And in the meantime, they took over. They have the east, the southeast of the country, and they're slowly but surely heading towards Odessa. And we'll probably have that they're not in a rush. So, but over time, however, if, you know, especially as the regime is falling apart, if they do something stupid, which already has been happening, but they do something overtly stupid, my guess is Kiev will be hit and hit hard. So many other places will too. And of course, you know, That will make, you know, the various U.S. arms manufacturers really happy because, oh, good, we can sell more arms. Because, again, who pays for those arms? Well, the U.S. taxpayer. You know what I mean? It's theft. But anyway. But the issue is, what happens to people when they find out, oh, the story I heard is not reality? You know, it can be devastating. It's like what I mentioned long ago about how Denis Rancourt mentions why people refuse to take off the mask. Because if you do that, if you say, oh, I was fooled into wearing a mask, you're admitting you were fooled and you don't want to do that. You can't, because, you know, that's pride. And of course, if your peers haven't got to that point, then you're even more trouble. So that's a problem. And, you know, I think about, you know, because it's not only the politics and like the mask and whatnot. I've mentioned things like the Thunderbolts Project, which discusses the electric universe theory or compared to the gravitational model. You can't do that if you're part of NASA because your job's at stake. Your job is more important than the evidence. So, you know, I wonder about that. And so all those various things, you know, like you got to hide from George the evidence, right? So one of the things that I've been working on is, oh, what is it called? Yes, Shofar Nexus. You know, and the underlying core of that is, you know, the private communications and things of that nature. And it scares people. Because who would it help? People like that man there could potentially benefit from that. The people I mentioned, because I mentioned to a gentleman today, it's not the Ukrainian government or the Lugansk government or the Donetsk government, you know, which are basically Russian, you know, in the Donbass, or the government in Crimea, which obviously is now literally part of Russia. It's not the governments. It's the people I'm concerned about, whether they happen to be people in Ukraine that speak Ukrainian or people in Ukraine that speak Russian. It's the people I'm concerning it about in Syria, in Iraq, in Kazakhstan, in Myanmar, in Kashmir, places that are going through some difficulty. Pakistan is getting really close, and obviously Sri Lanka is in the middle of it right now. Besides the issues that are going on like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria is having some problems. Numerous other places are having some significant difficulties. And it's not the governments. I'm not siding with one government or another, because again, I'm no longer siding with governments at all. I'm concerned about the people. And, you know, I'm not the guy that helps, you know, like I went to the farmer's market today. These are the people that can go help you raise food, for example, because they know how to do that. And they know how to do it well. Because I had some wonderful tomatoes today. They know how to do it well. But that's not me. I can handle things like communications, like privacy, like anonymous electronic currency, like ways to be not tracked. You know, I especially think one of the things I see a lot, you can see it especially in Ukraine, in so many of the cities, people live in these high-rise apartments. This is common in a lot of places in the world, but because Ukraine is so much in the news, you see this a lot. And, you know, one of the things that's being promoted by some, obviously, is the rebuilding of these high-rise apartments in the Mariupol area that were destroyed during this less-than-kind interaction. And that's a different culture. People living in an apartment complex versus me, I'm in a, you know, my three-bedroom house. I'm not in an apartment. And it really is a different culture. You know, I look down a driveway at trees as opposed to look out a window and I'm at the, you know, seventh floor. you know, it's a different culture. But one of the things that is there often is a community within that building. And one of the things I see, well, for a good example is, I just saw an event, and I think, it may have been Eva Bartlett, it may have been somebody else, it was RT. They were there and they said, okay, we need to get everybody away from here, get away from this particular building. Because there's a particular apartment complex, again, seven-story high or whatever it was. And there was, you know, the Ukrainian military was, they were defeated and they left the city. But what happens is sometimes some of the people change into civilian clothes and kind of hide. You know, a lot of them, they're left for dead by their own people. But sometimes, apparently, and this was an example of that, is they're... And one of the things I found fascinating is when they go to their bunkers and things of that nature, or where they have gone into these high-rise buildings and grabbed somebody's apartment, and they use it as a place to shoot from, when they... those places are captured, what they find is, you know, their arms and so forth, a lot of that stuff, and a lot of drugs. Apparently, a lot of these people are really high on amphetamines. And they fight literally for like 3 days straight. No sleep, just constant. You know, and I wonder about what that happens to people who do that. But the other side of the coin is, in this particular case, you have a man, well-armed, and he's in an apartment complex. And he's taking pot shots out of the windows. And, you know, these are just normal civilians going around. And he's taking pot shots at them. So, I don't know what the results were, but it was get people away, got the reporters away. And I don't know if it was... just the Donetsk military or with the Russian military together. I'm not sure what it was. Then they went into the building to find that man. And more than likely, it was not, please surrender, it's, you're dead. That would be my guess. But what I think about is because so often what happens, and I can see, I've heard about this, and this, in this case, it's not apartments, but kind of tight communities in Kashmir. So you have an apartment complex where you have these tight communities where people are living basically next to each other. Same thing is true in Sri Lanka, although they have a lot of the tall buildings too. But you have a tight community there. There may be close cooperation. There may be very distant. But what happens in like the case what's happening in Ukraine? Someone comes to your apartment complex to kill. One of the things that happens is when it's done, especially by the military, which is, you know, is they close you off, they cut off communications and things of that nature. But if you had it structurally already there, where the communications within that building did not require the external sources. In other words, it wasn't that we have to have a connection to the citywide internet, for example, in order to, or to satellite links or whatnot. But we have the communications within our building, so if our building is cut off from the rest of the world, we still can talk to each other. Things like that, I think, can be vital. And could be life or death. But I need to find somebody who says, yes, I know the need and I can get it there. I don't know how. Well, I know how, but I don't know how to get it there. You know, this is the idea of you know, the mesh network, what I call private routing and things of that nature. All these things are, it's doable, but I need somebody who says, yes, I want to do this because I want to go to the people of Lugansk, Donetsk, Kiev, who may be on different sides, people in Kashmir, people in Sri Lanka, in Myanmar, in Libya, and be their ally. Not, you know, the objective is, I want to fight our, you know, one government against another. No, I want to protect that community. It's really a big deal. So, what I need is somebody to again, do that. But then I also need the resources. You know, there is the rapid buyout that may transpire that may give me those resources. but at least for the next about 2 months, as of today, in the grace of God, I got funded. My focus is fixed. Shofar Nexus is the priority. I want to put the infrastructure in place. And as soon as that person shows up, I don't want to just simply hand them an idea, but hand them something that works. That is my goal. The resources are now in place. And I'm fully focused on that. Unlike this act of love that was responded to with hate, Shofar Nexus is an act of love. And until the Lord stops me, I will press on. And in the grace of the Lord, it seems like He's saying, press on. My lady, my wife, I think what I hope you're seeing is the character of the man you married. I love you and I want you back.